begin said he would stop the deep bore tunnel designed to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. Yesterday, he said he would not stand in the way of the tunnel if he's elected mayor. What do you think about that? Does this make you more or less inclined to vote for McGinn? We'll talk about it in 14 minutes. This is The Conversation. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. A budget crunch at the Seattle Public Schools this year has meant layoffs for 31 teachers, bigger class sizes in some classrooms, and four school closures. A Seattle parent who's analyzed the district's budget says administrative costs are way out of line. Meg Diaz used to be an analyst in business consulting where she parsed budgets, and today she's a stay-at-home mom with two children in Seattle Public Schools. She was active in the fight to stop school closures earlier this year. And in her spare time, she's been writing financial reports of the Seattle School District that she's posted on her blog. Recently, she presented a new report to the Seattle School Board. It's called Central Administration Efficiency in Seattle Public Schools. We've got a link to it on our website, kuow.org. And Meg stopped by our studios today. Meg, you compared the Seattle School District's administrative budget with spending in other large districts. What did you find?
I found that it was about 2.3% above the average, including Seattle in the average.
Your report found that the central administration full-time employees increased 48% since 1998. Enrollment in the same time period dropped 7.5%.
Right.
You found that central administration cost growth has doubled in the last decade. Now, the district says that they were running a very complex and diverse school district, and that would explain some of these higher costs. What did you find?
They are running a complex district, but the other large districts in the state in the last decade have changed enough in their demographics to be more comparable.
Now, you label these administrative costs as a burden. Why don't you think they might actually be helping in the education of students?
It's possible they are. But overall, because it is enough out of line with other districts, I would say in a time of budget shortfall, that kind of disparity indicates that maybe we're not putting our money where we need it in the classroom.
And that's kind of one of the conclusions you're drawing here, is that maybe the money is not being spent as well as it could be?
It is. I can't, you know, and that's mostly looking at the finances. There may be a justification the district has, but it should be made for that kind of large investment in that's outside of the classroom.
Now, you presented this to the school district. What kind of response have you gotten?
The school board said they were going to send it through the board's finance committee. They had noticed some issues in the budget and had asked Don Kennedy in August to report to them on it.
What do you hope would be the outcome of kind of presenting the district with this information? It sounds as though you're in effect asking a question that you want an answer to.
I am. I would like to know either why that money is in the central administration instead of in the operating budget for schools, or to see the central administration trimmed.
Well, we'll see what Don Kennedy, the chief financial officer, does in reaction to this. Have you had any one-on-one conversations with school board members?
I've had a couple, but, you know, to an extent, I'm a member of the public. There's not that much they can tell me, even though I do have questions.
And some good questions raised in this. Meg Diaz, who's an analyst in business consulting where she parses budgets, has applied those skills to looking at the Seattle School District budget. You can find Meg's report at our website, kuow.org. And the school district says that they are looking into it. Meg, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks a lot.
In the near future, the Puget Sound area will be home to 1,000 electric Nissan vehicles and the charging stations to help to power those. Washington State is one of five states participating in a three-year study funded by a $100 million grant from the Department of Energy. E-Tech is a clean energy transportation company, and they're building the infrastructure for this program. Clean energy is nothing new to the Pacific Northwest. There have been state initiatives that have pushed on power companies the responsibility for getting more of their energy from renewable resources. But it's commonly acknowledged that a huge source of these carbon fuels are the vehicles that we are driving around each day. Many of you have converted by going to hybrid vehicles, which are half electric and half gas powered. But some see the future as being electric cars that will run without using those vehicles, those types of power at all. Of course, that does also provide a draw on the electric grid. But those who look at this say that electric vehicles overall will still be a net gain for what we'll need to see if we're going to be reducing our carbon emissions moving forward. There's many interesting aspects to the use of electric cars. One is that as cars that are charging from the grid, they also are batteries and in effect can store energy. One of the big problems with our energy system is that it's very hard to store energy. But when you hook up all of these electric vehicles plugged in all across an area, they are suddenly able to not only be drawing from the system, but also providing energy back into the system when they're not being used. Big questions remain for electric cars. The range on them could only end up being about 100 miles, although according to some calculations, most people drive each day is 40 miles, so that these vehicles will be well within the range of the amount of time that people would need to go about their daily business. Electric cars have been mandated in the past in California. There have been electric cars on the road, but they have not proved to yet break through in the marketplace. If you go back and look at the history of electric vehicles, back in the early days, before the internal combustion engine got started, there were electric vehicles which were on the road being used. However, they have not been in wide use for many years since then. Battery usage is a big problem when it comes to electric vehicles. How are you going to be able to make those batteries small and compact enough to fit in cars? And also, how are you going to make them large enough to hold the energy charge that needs to be done? General Motors has been working on an electric car, the Volt, for some years now, and they promised to have a car out with a reasonable price that would be electric. The price keeps going up, and as you're aware, General Motors has been in huge financial trouble lately, but they continue to push forward on that electric vehicle. Meanwhile, here in Washington State, you'll soon be able to purchase a Nissan electric vehicle. Don Carner is the president of E-Tech, the company that's going to be putting this in place. Don, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How much will these Nissans cost?
Well, that's really for Nissan to decide, but they're saying that the pricing will be comparable to a similarly sized internal combustion engine vehicle. They haven't released a final pricing yet, but they plan to be quite competitive.
Now, where will the charging stations be installed? You don't want to be out there without the ability to recharge your car.
Absolutely, and that's what this project is all about. We will select 1,000 of Nissan's vehicle customers to participate in our program, and for their participation, we will install a charger at their home if it's a private individual, and if it's a fleet, we'll install a charger at the vehicle's overnight location. And then we're installing an equivalent number of chargers in commercial and public locations so that we will go out into the community and try and determine the best places for people to be able to charge. And from this project, then we'll learn where we've been successful and where we're getting high utilization of the chargers and where we're not. And that will allow us to fine-tune and our charger placements and do a better job in the future so that for the next 50 or cities or the next 500 cities in the U.S., that they have a roadmap, essentially, of where the best places are to put the chargers, how much charging infrastructure is necessary, and what other kinds of support are necessary for electric vehicle drivers. For example, how do you best communicate where the chargers are? Because they may not necessarily be clustered in more traditional fueling stations on street corners. They may be in employers' parking lots and parking garages, places that they're not readily visible.
When do you expect to see these 1,000 electric cars on the road, Don?
Well, Nissan will introduce the vehicles in the Washington area in the fourth quarter of next year, so it's about a year away yet. And then our anticipation is that we will have our 1,000 vehicles on the road within about 6 months, and then we'll study the use patterns of those vehicles and the utilization of the infrastructure for charging those vehicles over the next 18 to 24 months.
We'll check in with you and see how that's going. Don, thanks for talking to us today.
fabulous. My pleasure.
Don Carner, president of ETEC. They are, with funding from the Department of Energy, setting up some clean electric transportation, 1,000 vehicles they expect to have on the roads of Western Washington. With an unemployment rate of 9.3% in Washington State, thousands of people are collecting state unemployment benefits and navigating what can be a very confusing system. Michelle Matassa Flores was a reporter and editor at the Seattle Times for 20 years. She was laid off in December, and she recently wrote a piece for Crosscut about her experiences navigating the unemployment system. Michelle, what's been the most frustrating part for you?
Well, the requirement that you apply for 3 jobs every week in order to qualify for unemployment benefits is quite a strain when there aren't really that many jobs to be had out there, or even openings to find that are suited to you. So that's been a hard thing. And then finding answers to questions I've had along the way was actually even more frustrating.
Why has it been frustrating to get answers to your questions?
Well, I think that the whole system is under such a strain, and this organization WorkSource that helps people look for jobs had to staff up very quickly when the economy tanked as fast as it did. I think a lot of them just don't exactly know what the answers are to some questions, and they give mixed signals along the way.
The state unemployment system reasonably wants to make sure that people actually are looking for jobs, but this applying for 3 jobs a week, you point out, really doesn't comport well with the number of jobs that are available.
That's right, and it just leads to some wackiness. And I tried to give the whole system its due in my story and say that, yes, I think there are really good reasons for this requirement. I don't advocate getting rid of it. But it does cause you to apply for jobs that are way over your abilities, or sometimes way under your abilities. You know, I mentioned CEOs applying for kind of entry-level office jobs, which has happened. People applying for jobs not even reading the directions for the application. So it's putting a strain on the companies doing the hiring as well as on the people looking for work.
Because they're inundated with all these applications from people who are just doing it in order to fulfill the requirement of the unemployment office.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, thanks a lot for telling us about it, Michelle. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michelle Matassa Flores wrote a piece for Crosscut about her experiences with the state's unemployment system, and you'll find a link to that at kuow.org. If you ever miss anything on KUOW, all of our local programming, our local news stories, and our features are always findable at kuow.org. We've got a search engine there. If you remember anything about it, unemployment, for example, is regarding our last interview, or Seattle schools, you can do a search and find all of the stories we've done on that subject. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Mayoral candidate Mike McGinn has promised he would stop the tunnel project. Now he's saying he will uphold the agreement to build the tunnel. What do you think about this change? We're going to be talking about that in a minute. We'd like to get your thoughts right now at 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. KUOW 94.9 News and Information, a service of the University of Washington.
Support for KUOW comes from the area schools affiliated with the Pacific Northwest Association of Independent Schools. More information about open houses, financial aid, and the range of education choices, such as Lakeside School, are online at pnais.org.
54 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1220. Taylor Branch discusses his new book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, 20 minutes from now at 1240.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Is Seattle mayoral candidate Mike McGinn flip-flopping or flexible? The Seattle City Council yesterday voted 9-0 to enter into an agreement with the state of Washington to build a deep bore tunnel through downtown. The tunnel would replace the aging Alaskan Way Viaduct. After the vote, one of the city's biggest tunnel opponents, Seattle mayoral candidate Mike McGinn, issued a surprise statement saying that he would go along with the agreement. KUOW's Deborah Wong reports.
McGinn has made his opposition to the tunnel the primary focus of the mayor's race. He objects to the $4+ billion price tag and says Seattle should not be on the hook for close to $1 billion of that cost and for cost overruns. But yesterday, after the council vote, McGinn issued a statement saying even though he disagreed with the decision, he would not withhold the cooperation of the city government in executing it.
You know, given the 9-0 vote by the council, you know, I am obligated to, as mayor, if elected, follow through on what the council has agreed to so far.
But McGinn said he would continue to fight for Seattle's interests and ask tough questions about the tunnel's funding. That statement was quickly followed by a press release from his opponent, Joe Malahan. He accused McGinn of flip-flopping because he's seen the poll numbers and is fighting for his political life. One recent poll showed Malahan with a narrow lead in the mayor's race, although a large number of Seattle voters, about one-third of them, are still undecided. I'm Deborah Wong, KUOW News.
So what do you think about McGinn's announcement? 206-543-5869. You can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Here's what we heard from some of you earlier today.
I would just like to say, I feel like saying, I told you so to McGinn. I knew the minute he came out so strong against that tunnel, he was going to have to retract and eat humble pie. Which is exactly what he's doing.
You know, this just shows his immaturity and inability to lead. He's constantly changing his position, as also is Malahan. They have no experience in government. They just are not the right people at this time point in time, and we really need somebody with experience. And this is why I am still going to write in Mayor Nichols.
You know, for me, this is exactly the right thing for him to do. I really like McGinn for many of the other issues, you know, biking, commuting, and so forth. But I like the idea of a tunnel for what it would do for the waterfront. So to hear him say that he's open to it, you know, that he's not going to try to torpedo it, totally convinces me that I should vote for him.
Does it convince you to vote for Mike McGinn, or does it convince you otherwise? We're at 206-543-5869. Or you can write to us. Our email address is conversation@kuow.org. If you just joined us, we're talking about McGinn's announcement yesterday that he won't stop the tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. And McGinn says he has not softened his stand on the tunnel. But his website this morning still says Michael McGinn is the only candidate for mayor who will stop the tunnel. That's dated August 11th on his website. Yesterday, he said he won't. Your thoughts, 206-543-5869. If you're someone who voted for Mike McGinn in the primary because of that promise to stop the tunnel, what do you think about what he had to say yesterday? You can also write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Maybe you're someone who didn't want to vote for Mike McGinn because of his stand on the tunnel, and for you, this suggests a new maturity. 206-543-5869. Give us a call with your comments about what you think of Mike McGinn's announcement yesterday about the tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. Cynthia is listening to us today in the Green Lake neighborhood. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I am still enthusiastically supporting Mike McGinn, and I think he realizes that with a 9-0 vote, it would be very difficult to come in an adversarial way, and I think it's a mature position. And I think the fact that he's opposed the tunnel is good because there needs to be a voice that's looking at things more critically. And I think he's expressed great platforms on a lot of other issues, and he's not a one-issue candidate.
Did you support him before his announcement yesterday?
Yes, I do.
And it sounds as though you're okay with him not opposing the tunnel, as he announced yesterday. But before yesterday, did you think that he was going to keep fighting it? I mean, he was pretty clear about that in some of his statements.
Well, you know, he's got a lot of experience, and he's been successful working as a grassroots advocate for neighborhoods. And also, he's a lawyer, so he understands, as we all do, that we have to negotiate. We can't always do what's in our heart.
Thank you for your call, Cynthia. 206-543-5869. Mike McGinn spoke on this program back in August with Guy Nelson. That was the day he found that he made it into the general election.
Now is not the time to be putting $930 million of city taxpayer dollars into burying a tunnel on the waterfront. It's just not Seattle's highest priority. And 70% of Seattle already voted against that tunnel. So I don't know why we keep coming back to it. But apparently the elected officials seem to think that the votes of the public on this one just don't really matter. But, you know, this is why we hold elections, and that's why it'll still be an issue in this mayor's race.
Mike McGinn held a town hall in the University District, and one woman asked him this question.
Can you actually stop the tunnel at this point?
Yes. And the answer to that question lies in looking at the hurdles they actually have to overcome to build it. One is they have to raise $930 million from the city of Seattle. A bunch of that is utility rate increases. That has to be approved by the council. Another bunch is significant increase in the parking tax, which the council would have to approve.
Dog licenses.
Another is $300 million or so in property tax increases, which will require a vote of the people. The port has to come up with $300 million. The county has to come up with $170 million. You may have noticed, and we've noticed, they don't have money. So they don't yet have the resources in hand, and they're actually going to have to ask people to give them the resources. So that's a hurdle. Another hurdle is that the state law says that the city of Seattle has to pay all cost overruns. And the city of Seattle says that provision's illegal. Now, how is the state going to enter into a contract with someone to build the tunnel if whoever they enter into a contract is naturally going to say, hey, you know, how do we deal with change orders? How do we deal with additional costs? How do we deal with that? They're not going to take that risk. So the state's going to have to reopen its legislation approving it and deal with the cost overruns. And finally, we have an issue of we haven't even seen what they're proposing yet for tolling. They have to raise $400 million from tolling. And that really raises some question of why would people pay a toll after they paid all these taxes? So they have so many hurdles to overcome. I hope that elected leaders would look at doing something practical here rather than something impractical.
Mayoral candidate Mike McGinn, a statement that he made at a town hall forum in the university district where he said he could stop the tunnel. He said, look at the hurdles. One of them was approval that the Seattle City Council had to give. The council has done that yesterday by a 9-0 vote. But a lot of those other issues that he raised, for example, all throughout this campaign, he has said that people in Seattle do not support the tunnel. And he said that based on the fact that there was a vote against a cut-and-cover tunnel 2 years ago. And when I asked him that directly, he said that people in Seattle do not want this. Also, at one point, he said, do you think they could build a tunnel in the city if the mayor and the people opposed it? Well, he said in the past that the people opposed it. He said in the past that if he was mayor, he would oppose it. But now he's saying he doesn't oppose it. He'll go along with it. Now, do you see this as a sign of maturity, of him recognizing the reality of the situation? Or do you feel as though he's not the person who you voted for in the primary? 206-543-5869. Let's go to Douglas, who's listening to us today on Beacon Hill. Douglas, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, you know, I hear this flip-flopper accusation, and I remember John Kerry received that kind of criticism in the past. And I thought that was a very strange sort of thing to attack a politician for. I mean, the guy's showing he's got an open mind, that he can think about things, that he can react to a situation, that he's not, you know, yeah, that he's not like just a stick in the mud. And so I think this is a good thing. I cast my ballot. I mailed it yesterday. And I voted for Mike McGinn, and I was very ambivalent about it because I really don't think that we want to change our mind about the transportation options that we have. I think we want to go ahead and try to get some solutions. And so now I feel much better about my vote.
You know, I go back to that thing that I just read on the website today. Mike McGinn is the only candidate for mayor who will stop the tunnel. Am I being too literal here? I mean, that seems pretty clear cut.
No, I know he said that, and I voted for him yesterday before this announcement was made as a supporter of the tunnel, thinking, you know, I know he says that, but is he going to be able to stop it? And he may not be able to. And as a person and on all the other issues, I just think he's a much better candidate. So I thought, well, you know, I'll vote for him anyway.
Okay. Hey, Douglas, thanks for your phone call. So do you agree with Douglas that, yeah, you knew he said that, but you didn't think he really meant it? So what he said yesterday pretty much confirms what you thought he thought all along? Or are you a little bit literal about it and say that the only candidate for mayor who will stop the tunnel means that he was the only candidate for mayor that would continue to try to stop the tunnel? Greg's listening to us in the Ravenna neighborhood. Greg, thanks for taking the time to give us a call. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm really disappointed. I thought that, you know, you guys just play the clip where he was discussing all the problems with the tunnel, and I don't see how any of that has changed. And this is in his own words. If you know, it was as big of an issue as he's campaigned on, then I mean, the least he can do is explain how that's changed. I definitely don't see it as a sign of maturity. I see it as a sign of compromise and compromising his principles. I've got a lot of friends who worked in the campaign, or who are still working in the campaign, and they, you know, they decided that they were going to campaign on this issue, just for the purpose. I mean, and, you know, it was explained that it would be appealing to Seattle voters.
And have you talked to them since McGinn's announcement yesterday?
No, I'm planning to. I'm planning to antagonize them pretty soon, actually.
Well, did you vote for McGinn in the primary, Greg?
Yes, I did. And you know what? I really wish I'd voted for Nichols now. I feel like we lost an experienced mayor simply because he told the truth. And I don't feel like McGinn's been telling us the truth.
Greg, thanks for your phone call. Jim's listening to us today in West Seattle. If you just tuned in, we're reflecting on the announcement yesterday by Mike McGinn following a city council vote of 9-0 that he would not actively oppose the tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way viaduct. In the past, he has said he was the only candidate for mayor who would stop the tunnel. He says that it's not his role as a elected official to be that obstructionist, but he says he's going to continue to fight for Seattle's interests, including questions about the funding for the tunnel, which explicitly says Seattle people who own property that would benefit from the tunnel are going to be left on the hook for paying any cost overruns. Many people in Olympia say that just won't hold water. I mean, McGinn says he's going to fight on that. I'm asking what you think about this announcement today, which certainly is a surprise and, if not substantively different, is a big difference in tone from what Mike McGinn has been saying about this tunnel up until now. Jim, in West Seattle, what do you think?
Well, I think it's somewhat unfortunate for Mike McGinn. I met Mike when he came to the 34th District Democrats along with Joe Mallahan, and I listened carefully to both of what they had to say. At the time, I was undecided because in the primary, I voted for Greg Nichols. But after Mike had been so vociferous in his opposition to the tunnel, I said, you know, I live in West Seattle. I'm familiar with the transportation needs of this area, and not having a tunnel or any kind of other corridor through there is not being practical, one, and not showing good judgment. And I thought, you know, I'm going to vote for Mallahan, and that's exactly what I did 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really unfortunate because, you know, had he let us know in advance what he was going to do, I may have changed my mind. But then again, maybe not, because, you know, maybe this is what we needed to know as voters.
Right. Maybe so. Jim, thanks a lot for your phone call. Let's go next to Brad, who's listening in Ballard. Brad, what do you think about what Mike McGinn had to say yesterday about the tunnel?
I wasn't a big fan of Nichols, but I voted for him in the primary because I was worried about the other two candidates' experience. And now that we're in the general election, I really was taken aback and kind of shocked by McGinn's proposal for bringing back the monorail. But calling it a streetcar along the corridor between West Seattle and Ballard. I live in Ballard. Like your last caller, I really question how you can take away that corridor and not replace it with anything, and the cost of the street option is as high as it would be for the tunnel.
Well, what do you think about McGinn saying he's not going to actively oppose the tunnel now?
Well, I think, again, I think that it shows kind of an erraticness and inexperience, and it's actually kind of scary.
Okay.
That this guy could become mayor. And, you know, when I met him, he said he was a one issue candidate, which was against the tunnel, and now he's just throwing that aside to appeal to more people, I suppose.
Okay, Brad, thanks. I'm going to go on because I got some other people who want to talk to this issue. I've never heard him say he's a one issue candidate, Mike McGinn. Sarah's calling today from Capitol Hill. And Sarah, this term flip-flopper has been tossed around. You say he's not a flip-flopper. Why do you say that?
I say that because he hasn't changed his position. All that he said is that he accepts the council's decision, although he doesn't agree with it.
Well, explain this to me, though, Sarah. On his website today, Michael McGinn is the only candidate for mayor who will stop the tunnel. How does him yesterday saying that he would go along with the city council fit with that?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a contradiction in his view, contradicts the council. I mean, it goes against the council's view, you know. But just because he says, okay, I agree with you know, what they've come up with, I'm going to stand by whatever they decide, even though I don't agree with it.
No, I understand that, and that makes sense. And he gave good reasons for how, as mayor, he shouldn't be someone who obstructs a process that's already in motion. But he at one time said he would stop the tunnel. And I'm not sure how those two things fit together. When you say he's not a flip-flopper,
yeah.
How do you come to that?
Well, see, I'm not concerned about – this has been a battle that we've all been engaging in Seattle about what to do as far as the tunnel for years, you know. And I wish that there was a mayor that would start digging and just say, okay, we're going to do it.
Do or the tunnel.
Somebody that says, okay, we're not going to do it.
Right.
You know, but there just seems to be a lot of, I just don't feel that what he's doing is flip-flopping.
Okay, fair enough, Sarah. Thanks for your call. Martin joins us today from Seward Park. Martin, how do you read this latest move by Mike McGinn?
Well, first of all, wasn't that website dated in August?
It's up there this morning. The note says August 11th, but he's been – you could pick up his campaign literature, and it says that he opposes the tunnel. I mean,
well,
from that
I'm
time.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
I'm aware of that.
Okay. So we shouldn't hold him to what he said. We shouldn't hold him to what he said in August?
That's right.
Okay.
First of all, I did not vote for him in the primary. I voted for Nichols. If Nichols was running, I would vote for him today. However, as between the two men, I am because of what he did, I'm going to vote for him. He demonstrated that he has the ability to change his mind based on what a majority, a vast majority of the city council wants.
Okay, fair enough. Martin, thank you very much for your phone call. So some, like Martin, see this as a sign of political maturity. Others, it makes them a little nervous about what Mike McGinn really stands for. And if you have not voted yet, you're going to have to figure that out on your own. If you ever miss anything on KUOW, go to our website, kuow.org. Once you're there, you'll find a search engine that will get you to any of our stories or any of our discussions in the past. You can hear what Mike McGinn had to say in his previous interviews on KUOW by going to kuow.org. From KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch on his new book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, in a minute. 12:39.
Support for KUOW comes from Sound Transit, introducing the Orca Smart Card, good for use on all public transportation, buses, trains, and light rail in the Puget Sound region, including ferries. More on the Orca Card at orcacard.com.
Hi, I'm Ross Reynolds. All of us here at KUOW welcome all the new and renewing members who participated in the recent pledge drive. Thank you so much for making this drive so successful. When you get your pledge reminder, please be sure to return it as soon as you can. And once again, thanks so much for all of your support.
The dinner rush is about to start, and your waitress can't stop sneezing.
I don't think you want your waitress coming up with the bloody nose or with the cough. It's a judgment call. You know, we don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot. It will be a tough call.
All employees must wash their hands. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The high cost of not calling in sick. Next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
Tonight at 6:30. 94.9 KUOW News and Information.
Support for KUOW comes from the UPS Stores of Western Washington, offering packaging and shipping solutions to businesses of all sizes with digital printing, mailbox, notary, and other services. Locations at theupsstores.com.
54 degrees, mostly cloudy in Seattle's University District. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 12:40.
Historian Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of three books on Dr. Martin Luther King. Taylor Branch's new book is called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. And it's based on 8 years of secret conversations he had with President Clinton throughout his presidency. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot.
The situation around which this book occurred, I think, is really interesting. President Clinton called on you to, quote, take care of history in the White House. What did he mean by that? What did he want you to do?
He loves history almost as much as politics, and he, at his initiative, called me as president-elect and in a crowd surrounded by Secret Service said, I've only got a couple of minutes. I'm worried about the quality of the records that are going to be kept in my administration. And he said, I read the footnotes in your history books from other presidential libraries, and I want mine to be as vivid and allow vivid history to be written 50 years from now. Will you help me do it? Give him some advice. And I was stunned that he was thinking about that before he hadn't even taken office.
And there were a lot of negotiations that went on about exactly how this would take place and under what conditions it would take place.
Exactly. He thought originally that I might move into the White House and be like an in-house historian. He also even briefly considered taping his phone conversations, which has nobody president has done since President Nixon got driven out of the office for that. Nevertheless, I told him in a mature society we would record those conversations and keep our mitts off of them for 10 or 20 years or some agreed upon time, and because they would be indispensable to show how a people's government really works, particularly the presidency, which is the most personal of our branches of government. It's, all the powers are vested in one person, so there's no substitute for those personal talks. I told him I didn't think the Arthur Schlesinger idea was a good one, that in this day and age nobody would take an in-house historian to be objective, that I wouldn't feel objective if I did it, and that so I wouldn't recommend that he even have anybody do it, but I certainly wasn't going to do it because I was committed to finishing my Martin Luther King trilogy. I was only in the second book. Anyway, after a time, I recommended to him that a second best alternative to recordings or actual daily diary would be an oral history, which has developed since World War II as a way of preserving memories in the moment that are unguarded relative to a memoir looking backward.
So you would go to the White House once a month, sometimes not quite as often, and right. Spend long evenings just talking with the president, basically interviewing the president.
That's right. Underground rules again that took a long time about who should keep custody, how we could keep it secret. He was utterly convinced that if it got out that he was having these recorded conversations, a hue and cry would go up that people needed to get their hands on him to settle Whitewater or whether he really killed Vince Foster or some other conspiracy theory. So that ironically, we felt that in a project that was devoted to public access eventually to the president's unvarnished words, that the only way it could be done was in secret, including secret from his own staff. Only a few people on his staff knew about it. We didn't have sessions in the West Wing because there were too many staffers running around there even late at night. These were recorded in the residence upstairs in the president's residential quarters, where there were only butlers and a few ushers and the household staff and Chelsea and Hillary.
So you went in, you had these remarkable conversations with the president and also got quite a unique view of what it was like to be in the residence of the White House. You'd sneak in, you'd record the interviews, then you'd hand him the recordings, go back out, get in your car, drive home to Baltimore, and that's when you actually were doing your notes, which for what became this book, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I gave him the tapes. It took me a while to label them at the end. He carefully put them away. Not until the second term, actually, did he trust me, because we had kept it secret all this time, and he was amazed. Hillary was even more amazed. I advised her to do this, and she was too fearful that they would be compromised. In the second term, he told me where he was hiding them, because he was often getting called away right when we were finishing, so it was more convenient to him for me to put them away. And he showed me that he had been hiding them in his sock drawer in a closet right next to the bedroom there in the residential part of the White House, in the two boxes I gave him. And he'd say, please make sure they're all there and that both sets are there.
So why did you do it? I mean, for a historian to kind of leave the tapes behind and not have that record, that seems like that would be something that you would want to have.
I believe passionately that in a people's government, we need to have the most balanced human view of the people who run it. So I believe in presidential history.
How did the Clinton speaking to you these evenings and being recorded differ from the public Clinton that we read about?
More emotional in two ways. One, more emotional and vexed. There was a lot of venting, particularly in the beginning, that he felt the public persona of his presidency and what he was actually trying to do were somewhat different. He started off saying, look, my mission is to lift this country from a generation of cynicism, because from our point of view, and he's talking to me as white Southerners, we think the reputation of government in our lifetime ought to have been enhanced by what happened to eliminate segregation and free the South from terrorism and create the Sunbelt South and destigmatize Southern politicians and empower women and all the things that have been set loose. But in that same period, since the 1960s, there's been a cynicism about government and the reputations of politicians have plummeted. And Clinton loved politics, and he felt that reputation was undeserved, that if you looked at it on balance, which is why he's wrestling history, he thinks that our own history about political potential was jaundiced, and that he wanted to do things like, say, we can end the national deficit. We can increase high-wage jobs. We can be a force for peace around the world. And he did all of those things, but he was very, very frustrated that the general political culture seemed more fixated on tabloid scandals than even paying any attention to that sort of thing. I felt it a lot when he went into Haiti to restore the elected president of Haiti in an anguish. We had a session the night beforehand, and there was an undercurrent of blame toward me, saying, I've never done anything this foolish politically. I have 8% support. I'll be impeached. I'm going to do it anyway because it's right. And he did it. And there was practically no notice. It didn't really register. You know, this is the poorest country in the hemisphere. They have a chance to establish a democracy. Do we care? It just vanished. And then the next session, I went back and he said, people are still saying I never do anything that's not popular. That's my only barometer. How can you reconcile that with going into Haiti with 8% public support? So there was a lot of crying in the night, I would say. But more than that, there was endless, endless cerebral speculation about why this was. He's a theorizer and a puzzle worker. Clinton is just relentlessly thoughtful.
Taylor Branch is my guest, and we're talking about an extraordinary project that he was part of. He recorded Bill Clinton in the White House after hours, secretly. Very few people knew about this, talking about his presidency. And the idea was to provide a historic document. And these recordings were held onto by the president and used by the president in his own autobiography. And we need to mention that you're not only an esteemed historian, but you were well known to Bill Clinton.
Yes, we had known each other as anti-war activists back when we were in our 20s, just well enough that when the George McGovern campaign asked the two of us to go in and manage their Texas campaign, we agreed to do it. They said the Texas Democrats were feuding as always, and they wanted two non-Texas Southerners to try to mitigate their feuds. And so we went down together and got an apartment, and he asked if he could bring his new girlfriend, Hillary, and I said, fine. So the three of us got an apartment. And went through a very, very intense, unsatisfying shellacking, you know, to be Democrats.
I was going to say, talk about the Alamo.
We were the Alamo campaign. And people have asked me since, did I come out of there knowing that Bill Clinton was an extraordinary politician and might be president? I said, are you kidding? We lost by 30 points. We didn't think we were fit for politics. But he still loved politics and went straight back to run for Congress. Hillary and I went back to Washington. I into journalism. The irony of that was I was disillusioned by politics then. We had gone through two elections in which the people had voted against the Vietnam War and still killed 50,000 Americans and a million Vietnamese, and we were still in the middle of it. And in Texas, Clinton and I, as 25-year-olds, spent a lot of our time managing feuds between squabbling Texans over who sat where in the motorcade and that sort of thing. It seemed very petty. And I told him I wasn't going to do it. I was going to go into the written word and write about things, that there was more integrity there. And during our project 25 years later, he remembered that, and he said he remembered what he told me. He said, Taylor, if you want to try to solve big problems in the world, you have to develop a capacity to handle squabbles over who sits where in the motorcade, because that's part of human nature. And we've got to work through human nature, not around it. And it made me really rethink. I had thought that that was just his automatic pilot ambition at the time when we were in our 20s. And in a way, it may have been a little bit more mature than I was, because I was trying to get away from all of these squabbles.
I'm talking with Taylor Branch about his book, about his conversations with Bill Clinton. I got to say, though, Bill Clinton is a famously great one-on-one politician and famously great in person in a formidable presence,
mm-hmm.
and you were his friend. And you admit that you were kind of concerned about being snookered by Bill Clinton in going through this interview process.
Mm-hmm.
Were you?
Possibly. I mean, it's certainly enough of a worry that I do not present this as an evaluation of Bill Clinton. This isn't a history. That's one reason I didn't want to be his Arthur Schlesinger. I said, first of all, not enough time has passed for objective history. And second of all, I don't pretend to be objective if I'm going to be sitting here collecting this history. What I present this as is two things, a fundamental record of in-the-moment recollections as he has them of things that otherwise would be lost.
We should also mention that your wife worked as a speechwriter for Hillary Clinton. So not only were you going to the White House and seeing this, but your wife was also closely involved with what was going on. And you relate a story about how after the president left office, you were on a panel on Meet the Press. And during one of the breaks, there was some joking being made about the president's sex life and about the dog being let out now that he was out of office. And you kind of took that as to be quite an insult towards the president. And I was kind of surprised to read as a former journalist that you seem to take somewhat of a dim view of Washington journalists.
Well, I was surprised on Meet the Press. Yes, he's still in office. And the show was supposed to be on what's the legacy of Clinton. Clinton had just said we're on a path to pay off the national debt by 2010. We've created 20 million new jobs. Unemployment was 4.2%. And they were still pursuing the last gasp of peace initiatives in the Middle East. So he was talking about all of these things. And on Meet the Press, it was they were saying, well, his legacy is scandal. And by the way, we know he's already off running around with other women. And then they went to commercial. And that just totally undercut. It was like nobody was interested in the objective record. We went to commercial. And I said to them, to Tim Russert and who else was on there, Bill Bennett, how do you know this about other women? What other women? Why isn't this a story? Why isn't this a real story instead of just a little bit of locker room gossip,
line, yeah.
a throwaway gossip? Yeah. And their answer was to start singing Who Let the Dogs Out until the commercial was over. And to me, I thought it was childish, and they were essentially saying, we know this to be true, and we don't care that we don't have any evidence because this makes a really great story. And to me, that's irresponsible.
You do, though, talk about how there's always a connection between the personal and public, and you speculate that perhaps one of the reasons that Martin Luther King Jr. worked so hard to achieve those civil rights goals were in part perhaps to solve his conscience about his extramarital affairs. Oh. So how does that play into the president's private life and how he was as president?
In Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it plays directly in. I mean, he said flat out in one of the more affecting moments that we were talking that his chief character flaw for his whole life was self-pity and that he was feeling sorry for himself, that his presidency was misinterpreted, misinterpreted, and the actual governance disregarded entirely by the fixation on the tabloid stuff, and that he forfeited his accounting that he had worked so hard to be able to say all of that was empty by giving them Monica Lewinsky. He forfeited his chance to lift the world above its cynicism. Now, he is responsible for that, and he said he cracked and that would always weigh against his record. But he also said, look, if cynicism is a problem for the United States, if we're going to need to politics to help us dig out of severe problems. Because believe me, if things get bad enough, people will turn to the government. They're not going to turn to General Motors. They will turn to the government. If we need it, it's up to us to dig out from that cynicism. And, you know, I'm sorry I didn't help more.
Well, in fact, didn't he, in effect, deepen that cynicism with the Monica Lewinsky affair?
I don't know whether he deepened it or not, because, after all, this is one furtive affair in a White House where people have carried on with multiple mistresses and not deepened cynicism. But he certainly allowed the people who wanted to believe that government is a scourge, or as Clinton puts it, that government and politics can't organize a two-car funeral. If they want to believe that it's our problem and that we can't work together to accomplish good things, Monica Lewinsky validated that belief and relieved them from the civic duty to say, how do we weigh, what kind of balance do we have on Clinton's presidency, what he did well and what he did bad.
We're wrestling today with the whole issue of health insurance reform for the first time since it was undertaken at the very beginning of the Clinton presidency. And it was famously a big failure. It kind of fell apart. The program, designed pretty much in secret, largely designed by Hillary Clinton, failed to get the support that it needed. And I'm curious about whether any of your conversations with the president from around that time have a bearing to what we're seeing unfolding today in Washington, D.C., as health care reform again comes to the forefront.
Good question. Many, many, many of them did. I mean, it was kind of, health care was through there all along. I mean, he said variously at some point, he said that he did health care too soon after the Big Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993, because Republicans at the time were saying it was going to wreck the economy, there was a tax increase that was going to increase unemployment, cost jobs. And he said, I should have waited to disprove that, because it didn't. But he didn't wait long enough to then introduce health care. So the Republicans lumped the two of them together as socialism, basically as a big government, big tax takeover.
That sounds familiar.
And took him apart. So he said, I should have waited. He said, I probably should have allowed Congress to be more involved in health care, but it would have taken a long time, and then I would have been waiting a really long time. And, of course, that's the tack that Obama took. President Clinton said that when you present one big bill, complexity works in the favor of the critics. And because health care is complex, if you present this big bill, they can take little pieces of it and distort them and leave you trying to defend an albatross.
That's historian Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of America in the King Years. His most recent book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, based on conversations he had over both administrations with Bill Clinton at night. There was a secret to all but some of his closest aides. Our program is produced by David Hyde with Jenny Asarno, and we get production help from Andrew Walsh, Heidi Lang, Julia Rudick, and Amy Rainey. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. From KUOW, I'm Ross Reynolds.
And I'm Bernard Ouellette. 1259, KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle, KUOW 1340 AM Tumwater Olympia. At the United Nations yesterday, Canada asked for a worldwide truce during the upcoming Winter Olympics. British Columbia will host the 2010 Games in February, Tom Bonsi reports.
The Vancouver Olympics will be the ninth try by the modern Olympic movement to revive an ancient Greek tradition. Greece's ambassador to the United Nations, Anastasios Mitsialas, told the General Assembly that promoting peace was the reason the Olympic Games were originally established.
In antiquity, the implementation of the Olympic truce entailed a cessation of all hostilities to allow thousands of athletes, pilgrims, and spectators to travel to Olympia and attend the sacred celebration.
The General Assembly accepted the Olympic truce resolution without objection, but Ambassador Mitsialas was the first to say he holds no illusions of how challenging it would be to realize a worldwide truce today. On Thursday, Canadian officials will light the Olympic flame in Greece, starting a long torch relay that ends in Vancouver next February. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. SCCA recognizes that where people are treated first for cancer often matters. SCCA's doctors treat lung, breast, and other